We live in a culture where to accept Walt Whitman, we've had to kind of neuter him and remove his sexual self. And it makes it really hard to understand Whitman.
People kind of don't know what to expect with us. I don't think we actually neatly fit into one genre.
Since you've been gone, I can't breathe for the first time.
Welcome to This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. A lynch mob demands the quick execution of gay-accused Nigerians, a Whitman worshiper uncensors the poet, and a well-strung boy band fiddles fabulously. All that and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Natalie Peoples.
And I'm Michael Allen.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending January 25th, 2014. The crisis for sexual minorities in Nigeria has deepened on the heels of President Goodluck Jonathan's mid-January signature on draconian anti-gay legislation. Aside from making it a crime for same-gender couples to wed, the Same-Sex Marriage Prohibition Act punishes consensual adult gay sex with harsher prison terms than the up to 14 years already prescribed in the country's mostly evangelical Christian North, and from lashings to execution under Islamic law in the primarily Muslim South. The measure also outlaws organizations that support LGBT rights, social or political gatherings for sexual minorities, and even public displays of same-gender affection. And anyone who provides services to a known gay or lesbian person could spend up to 5 years behind bars. A Sharia court in the northern Nigerian city of Bauchi was surrounded earlier this week by thousands of shouting, stone-throwing demonstrators demanding the speedy conviction and execution of at least 7 men being tried for belonging to gay advocacy groups. Security forces fired into the air and used tear gas to disperse what the local media called a lynch mob, so that the accused men could be safely returned to prison. The same court sentenced a young man to a 20-lash public whipping last week, sparing him from being stoned to death because the offense he had confessed to took place years ago and he had not committed such acts since. The 7 men now reportedly standing trial were rounded up following the enactment of Nigeria's internationally condemned anti-gay law. It's unclear when their trial will resume. 6 other men were reportedly arraigned on similar charges under the new law this week.
But a well-known Kenyan writer has come out in protest of the Nigerian law and the equally horrendous anti-gay law apparently still pending in Uganda. Binyavanga Wainaina has published what's been described as the missing chapter of his acclaimed 2011 memoir, One Day I Will Write About This Place. The news story appeared January 19th on the Africa is a Country blog. Called I Am a Homosexual Mom, Wainaina describes coming out to his mother on her deathbed. Wainaina became famous overnight when media mogul Oprah Winfrey praised his debut memoir. According to The Advocate, he also posted a 6-part documentary on YouTube this week about homosexuality in Africa called We Must Free Our Imaginations. Wainaina is founder of the influential Nairobi-based literary journal Kwani. He won the prestigious Kane Prize for African Writing in 2002 for one of his short stories. Despite his outspoken criticism of the anti-gay laws in Nigeria and Uganda, Wainaina is not afraid to continue traveling to those countries, as he's been doing for many years. He told London's Guardian newspaper that, "I'm a Pan-Africanist. I belong to this continent."
This week's flurry of news about marriage equality in yet more U.S. states includes diverging attorneys general, more court maneuvers, and shameless Republican political shenanigans. Virginia's newly inaugurated Attorney General, Democrat Mark Herring, announced this week that he would not defend the state's constitutional ban on marriage equality in pending lawsuits against it because marriage is a fundamental right being denied to some Virginians, and the ban unlawfully discriminates on the basis of both sexual orientation and gender. Even though voters approved the constitutional amendment in 2006 by more than 14 percentage points, recent polls show that nearly half of them now support marriage equality. Republican lawmakers are demanding that Herring fulfill his obligation as Attorney General to defend all state laws. Anti-gay groups like the National Organization for Marriage are calling for his impeachment. Two federal lawsuits challenging Virginia's constitutional ban on same-gender civil marriage are moving forward in a relatively speedy fashion. One was filed by the American Civil Liberties Union and Lambda Legal. The other is being spearheaded by David Boies and Ted Olson of the American Foundation for Equal Rights, the same legal team that won the Proposition 8 case in California.
But a federal judge has approved the intervention in an Idaho lawsuit against that state's marriage equality ban by Republican Attorney General Lawrence Wasdin. Even though Governor C.L. Butch Otter is already a defendant in the case, U.S. Magistrate Candy W. Dale ruled this week that the Attorney General was entitled to assert the state's defense of the law. Four same-gender couples filed the lawsuit challenging Idaho's heterosexuals-only marriage statute in November. Like similar filings in other states, the suit charges that the statute violates the U.S. Constitution's equal protection and due process guarantees.
And Nevada's Democratic Attorney General Catherine Cortez Masto urged the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals this week to uphold her state's constitutional ban on marriage equality by linking it to incest and bigamy, which are also outlawed in Nevada. The American Civil Liberties Union filed suit against the civil marriage equality ban there in October.
A federal appeals court has granted Utah's request for more time to prepare opening arguments in defense of that state's ban on marriage equality. Despite opposition from attorneys for the plaintiff couples, the 10th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals gave the state until February 3rd to submit its initial briefs. The appeals court is reviewing a December 20th decision by a federal judge that overturned Utah's law prohibiting lesbian and gay couples from legally marrying. More than 1,000 same-gender couples tied the knot until the U.S. Supreme Court halted those weddings on January 6th. While the federal government recognizes those marriages, Utah does not. Four legally wed, same-gender couples filed suit against the state this week, demanding that it legally recognize their unions.
A federal judge in Eugene, Oregon, has decided to consolidate two separate lawsuits challenging that state's 2004 voter-approved constitutional amendment defining marriage as exclusively heterosexual. Judge Michael McShane, an Obama appointee, scheduled oral arguments for April 23rd. Meanwhile, a petition drive is underway to put the issue on Oregon's November ballot. Organizers have until July 3rd to collect the required number of valid signatures to qualify the measure.
Six same-gender couples filed suit this week against the state of Florida for the right to marry. They also argue that Florida's constitutional ban on civil marriage for lesbian and gay couples, approved by voters in 2008, violates the U.S. Constitution.
Meanwhile, an Indiana State House committee approved a bill to constitutionally ban same-gender couples from civil marriage this week in a 9-3 party-line vote. It's already against the law in Indiana, but supporters want to buttress the prohibition ahead of a possible court challenge. Minority Democrats accused Republican Indiana House Speaker Brian Bosma of a political power play to get the bill out of committee. He had a day earlier moved the measure out of the House Judiciary Committee, where passage was uncertain, to the Elections and Apportionment Committee, where the outcome seemed more assured. The marriage inequality proposal will next be voted on by the entire Indiana House. If it wins there, it would need to pass in the Senate before appearing as a ballot measure for final voter approval.
Elsewhere, Russia's most well-known anti-gay thug, Maxim Marcinkovich, was arrested on an international warrant this week after fleeing to Cuba to avoid being tried for extremism. The state-run Russian news agency, RIA Novosti, reports that the neo-Nazi will be extradited sometime soon to face those charges at home. The violent bully has led what he called an Occupy Pedophilia campaign across Russia that uses online chat rooms to lure young gay men to meetings for what they think is a date, then shows them in posted videos surrounded by gangs of tormentors, being humiliated, assaulted, and forced to confess their homosexuality. Marcinkovich was released from prison in 2010 after serving a 3.5-year sentence for incitement to hatred. But according to BuzzFeed, the current charges against him stem from other videos he released last year that praised skinhead culture, supported anti-immigrant riots, and insulted World War II veterans. The online news site notes that none of the reports cite Marcinkovich's homophobic videos as the reason for his arrest.
Russian Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev told CNN this week that he's heard no complaints about the national law criminalizing promotion of non-traditional sexual relations to minors from his country's gays and lesbians, the very people, of course, who've been silenced by it. Medvedev also claimed that no one has been prosecuted for breaking the law, a demonstrably false statement. And his assertion came a few days after a viral video captured a young man in the Russian town of Voronezh being roughly arrested for holding up a rainbow flag as the Olympic torch relay passed by. The well-respected Human Rights Watch says anti-LGBT violence has escalated in Russia since the law banning gay propaganda was enacted last June.
In related news, Canada's most decorated female ice hockey player, Haley Wickenheiser, an outspoken critic of Russia's anti-gay laws, was named this week by her country's Olympic Committee as the flag bearer for next month's opening ceremonies. Wickenheiser is considered one of her sport's trailblazers for having played with and against men on professional teams in Finland and Sweden. She said this week that the Olympics should be about including everyone, treating everyone with respect.
And finally, snowboard cross rider Belle Brockhoff is the only out athlete on the 56-member Australian Winter Olympics team. She told reporters this week that she'll do limited interviews before her event, but that she wants to talk afterwards with as many people as possible about Russia's anti-gay law and her disdain for President Vladimir Putin, who this week equated homosexuality with pedophilia. "After I compete," she said, "I'm willing to rip on his ass."
That's News Wrap for the week ending January 25th, 2014. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon, recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles, and produced by Steve Pride.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org. where you can also read the text of this newscast. I'm Natalie Peoples.
And I'm Michael Allen.
Extra, extra, read all about it. Extra!
Have you checked our website lately? For now playing information and behind-the-scenes news about your favorite international LGBT radio show, log on to thiswayout.org.
A well-endowed gay quartet will pluck for you later in the program.
I wonder, wonder who wrote the book of love.
Tell me, tell me, tell me, oh, who wrote the book of love? I've got to know the answer. Was it someone from above?
I wonder, wonder who wrote the book of love.
It's not too much to say that Walt Whitman changed Western culture. The complex blending of spirituality, sexuality, and the American experience in his poetry are indelible, despite the 19th century mores that forced him to write cryptically about his relationships with men, and despite the literary straightwashing of later eras. That's what performance artist Patrick Scully is trying to portray in his multidisciplinary work in progress about Whitman's life and work. Correspondents Dixie Tracker and John Townsend talked with Scully about the project.
You have a new piece you're working on about the poet Walt Whitman. Tell us.
I'm calling the piece Leaves of Grass Uncut. The un has to do with the fact that in order to have the place that he's had in the American canon, Whitman's been sanitized a lot. And, you know, I think we live in a culture where to accept Walt Whitman, we've had to kind of neuter him and remove his sexual self. And it makes it really hard to understand Whitman if you don't understand his sexuality, because it was such a huge part of his motivation to write was to explain who he was and what drove him and what his passions were. He had a line something like, "Sex, sex, sex, underneath it all is sex."
When was the times that he was writing? Because there was a lot of censorship going on, just as there is today, but in a different way.
Whitman was really first writing Leaves of Grass starting at about 1849 or 1850. And the forces that would have censored him were numerous. In the beginning, it had even more to do with the fact that there wasn't a language to write about his love for other men, because there wasn't a cultural framework for it. The closest that there was a phrase in Latin, which translates basically to "that sin which amongst Christians shall not be named." And so if somebody was being tried for sodomy in court, they often wouldn't even say sodomy. They would say this Latin phrase, because I think the idea in the times was, if you say this, people will hear it. And if they hear it, they'll think it. And if they think it, they might do it. And so the best best thing is to just refer to it in Latin so that there isn't even a chance that it like lands with anybody. And so Whitman really was about trying to write himself into being.
And how did Walt handle that then? Give us some examples.
Well, the word homosexual didn't exist yet. Walt sometimes, in casual language, would refer to things as being Greek. At one time, he said to somebody something about a member of our circus. But in his poetry, he invented some terms. He talked about the love of comrades. He talked about adhesiveness, which came from the pseudoscience of phrenology and the study of the shape of the human head. But for him, amativeness, which came from that same field, was about the passion that might exist between a man and a woman. And adhesiveness was about the passion and friendship that would exist between two people of the same gender. And so Walt went about inventing these words. He faced this enormous challenge. He was smart enough to know that if he wrote directly about things, that it would be rejected outright. So he had to write about things in code so that he could allude to things without being explicit when it came to talking about same-sex desire. I've kind of come to the conclusion that in 1860, when he published the third edition of Leaves of Grass, and it was expanded each time that he published it, the third edition included a very important homoerotic component called the Calamus Poems. But it also included a section that translates to Children of Adam, which were more heterosexual in their orientation. And in the heterosexual part, it's much more graphic and much more explicit. And in the homoerotic part, it's much more suggestive. It's almost as if he thought, okay, if I'm going to get this gay stuff in there in a soft way, I've got to put this straight stuff in there in a way that's more hardcore so that people are going to be distracted by this and let this other stuff, you know, it's not even going to register. Another much more blatant example of the kind of censorship he faced in 1880, when he wanted to come out with the next version of Leaves of Grass, the Attorney General of the state of Massachusetts said, "If you attempt to publish that in Boston, I'll have it declared obscene, and then it won't be able to be sent through the mail." And of course, the mail was the only way to distribute things at that time. So Whitman had to take the printing plates from the printing press in Boston down to Philadelphia and have the book printed in Philadelphia, where the Attorney General of Massachusetts didn't hold sway.
19th century was a very, there were some really harsh attitudes, and, you know, the women couldn't vote.
And in doing the research for this show, I've had the opportunity to really, like, dig into the 19th century. This is a show that's going to be a reflection of what Whitman struggled through and what he accomplished. So opera, dance, theater, and then there will also be poetry. So this play, using all of these different media, will be a way to explicate Whitman's lovers, Whitman's admirers, Whitman's enemies, and all kind of in one show. Because I think it's really important for Whitman to be known as a poet who loved men. And I think it's important for our culture at this time to be able to claim him for the gay community.
And so this is a work in progress.
My goal really is to have this ultimately be a one-man show so that I can take it on the road as Hal Holbrook has done with Mark Twain for the last 60 years. But the dancers that I'll use will probably be live in the first version that I have this summer. But I've been raising funds to pay the dancers and the videographers so that I can record these dances. And then in the future, if there's not the budget, when I'm performing it to have live dancers, that I've got the recordings of these dancers to project. The show will be structured so that it can be done either way, because I want to perform this piece for the rest of my life. I'm ready to create a piece that has the kind of staying power that I'll be able to perform it here and on tour till I can't get on stage anymore.
I can tell that this is coming right out of the core of your being, Patrick. It's exciting.
And it's very exciting for me. You know, I get to take themes that I've worked with in my own autobiographical material for decades of bringing personal queer existence into part of the cultural landscape of the world that we live in. I get to keep doing that. Instead of doing it autobiographically, I get to do it with Whitman's biography.
Performance artist Patrick Scully intends to launch Leaves of Grass Uncut with a mid-year workshop presentation. He's been sharing his story with Dixie Trichel and John Townsend.
I'm Stephen Fry. The great Oscar Wilde once said, "The only sin is stupidity." That is why it is imperative that we stay as informed as possible. An excellent way to do this is to listen to This Way Out, the international radio program for all our sexually diverse communities.
What do you get when you cross a string quartet with a boy band? For one thing, this lyrical lilt by This Way Out Entertainment correspondent Steve Pride.
The moment I heard the new CD from these four fetching fiddlers, this bevy of stringed beauties, this queer quartet of maestro models, I pause for only the briefest of pervy alliteration, then immediately orchestrated an interview with the men of Well Strung.
Hey, I'm Chris Marchant.
I'm Daniel Shevlin.
Hi, this is Trevor Wadley.
Hello, I'm Edmund Bagnell.
And we are Well Strung.
I'm Edmund, and I'm first violinist. My grandparents bought a violin for me, but it was kind of silly because they got a full-size violin, whereas normally kids get, you know, half-size, quarter-size. I definitely needed a quarter-size because I was six when I started. But my parents liked the idea, so they got me violin lessons and a new properly sized violin, and I've been playing ever since.
I'm Chris. I'm the second violinist. When I was a kid, my mom told me that I had to do something, like some kind of activity, and I was terrible at t-ball. I couldn't even hit the stationary ball off the tee. So I quit that and started playing violin instead.
This is Trevor. I play viola. In fifth grade, I started in a public school program. I started on violin. I didn't really have anyone in my family or community that I knew whom played. I don't know. It was something that was foreign to me, and I wanted to figure it out and see what it was all about. So I started.
I'm Daniel, and I'm the cellist. For me, it was probably third grade. Sort of an activities coordinator just came around to our schools, and anyone who wanted to play a stringed instrument could sign up. And at the time, I actually signed up to play violin. And so I played violin for about a year, but then my string teacher, she actually needed more cellos. And so I guess I was just more drawn to the sound of a cello because I was just decided to switch then and there. And so that's how I started playing the cello.
Since you've been gone, I can't breathe for the first time. I'm so moving on, yeah, yeah. Thanks to you, now I get, you should know.
I was doing another show in Provincetown in 2010, and I would play a violin on the street to make extra money. And a theater producer in town, Mark Cortali, approached me, and we started collaborating on a project because he knew that I sang as well. So we just started tossing ideas around and came up with putting a spin on the standard string quartet. I found Daniel through a mutual friend on Facebook, and I just sent him a message. He was living in Denver at the time, and I was like, hey, you should move back to New York and do this instead. So he eventually did, and then right after that happened, Edmund and Trevor showed up to our auditions.
The reaction has been fantastic. I think the most common reaction, I would say, in a way, is surprise. We get a lot of people who are like, well, I saw this advertisement for the show and I thought it was going to be kind of good for a few laughs. And then after the show, they're like, wow, you guys really impressed me. So I think people kind of don't know what to expect with us. I think what you were saying earlier about what is our genre, I don't think we actually neatly fit into one genre, and I think that's why people don't know what to expect with us. But we're pioneering the way, right? Yeah.
We got our start in Provincetown. That's where most people heard about us for the first time, and they have Naked Boy singing up there and a couple other nude shows. So people, I think, just assumed that that's what we did, but no, not the case.
We just were trying to have a witty name.
Yeah.
A little cheeky.
Cheeky.
The other misconception, I think also based on the name, is that we don't actually play very well or that it's a gimmick and we just like made up a funny show and are pretending to play violin or something. I think a few people that we've come across have had that perception of us, and then they come away realizing that we are real full-time musicians.
We tend to gravitate towards pop music because if you think about classical music of the time, it was popular music of its time.
Right. All music was new at one time.
Yeah. And so I think there's some subtle beauty in trying to combine both of them. And at the same time, kind of keeping true to the roots of a string quartet. while doing this new thing of singing and playing at the same time. And
there are no other singing string quartets, so we're kind of making it up as we go.
We could have had it all.
Starting Provincetown, you know, that brings a certain audience with it, just inherent to who goes there in the summer. But as we've been touring around the country, our audience has definitely been more mixed. A lot of teenagers, actually, which is
and kids.
Cool. Yeah, kids, families. What is so cool about what we do is that we appeal to a truly broad range of people. We'll have kids and then like 80-year-olds in our audience, and everybody seems to leave having a really great time. And I think that's pretty special, you know, creating a cool night out for a wide variety of people.
We just happened to all be gay. It wasn't the point of the show at all. It just happens to be that way, and it's not something we focus on in the show. It's just a fact.
Well, also, and we were also created, not created in P-Town, but, you know, a lot of where we got all of our grounding was in P-Town, and obviously it's a predominantly gay audience. So in order to get a good jump, I'm sure a lot of our content in our first show was a little bit more gay-centric. And there's still moments, but it was never intended to be like a gay show or a, you know, it's just part of who we are, but it's not what defines us, I don't think. I think our music should be what defines us.
So what? I'm still a rock star. I got my rock moves and I don't need you. And guess what? I'm having more fun, and now that we're done, I'm gonna show you tonight. I'm alright, I'm just fine, and you're a tool, so what? I'm still a rock star, I got my rock moves, and I don't want you tonight.
Find more information about Wellstrung online at well-strung.com. This is Steve Fry. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, Natalie Peoples, Michael Allen, Dixie Trickle, and John Townsend, and Steve Pride contributed program material. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Funding for This Way Out comes from the Yovana Foundation and our listeners. Thank you. Find out how you can help at thiswayout.org, where you'll also find program information, audio gift ideas, check out our two latest offerings, and links to our podcasts, blog, and Facebook page. You can also hear This Way Out on iTunes. Follow TWO Radio on Twitter, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on WPKN Bridgeport, Connecticut, KZSC Santa Cruz, California, CITR Vancouver, British Columbia, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.